Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Turn to the page. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 7th chapter, text number 40. Etan me prachita prashnan. Etan me prachita prashnan. Hare karma vivitsaya. Hare karma vivitsaya. Bruhi me gyasya mitratvad. Bruhi me gyasya mitratvad. Ajaya nasta chakshushaha. Ajaya nasta chakshushaha. Etan me prachitaha prashnan. Hare karma vivitsaya. Bruhi me gyasya mitratvad. Ajaya nasta chakshushaha. Vaishnavis. Etan, all these, may, mine, prachitaha, of one who inquires, prashnan, questions, hare, of the Supreme Lord, karma, pastimes, vivitsaya, desiring to know, bruhi, kindly describe, May unto me. Ajnasya, of one who is ignorant. Mitradvat, because of friendship. Ajaya, by the external energy. Nastachakshusha, those who have lost their vision. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. My dear sage, I have put all these questions before you with a view to knowing the pastimes of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are the friend of all, so kindly describe them for all those who have lost their vision. So that was Vidura speaking to Maitreya, purport. Vidura put forward many varieties of questions with a view to understanding the principles of transcendental loving service to the Lord. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 41, devotional service to the Lord is one, and the mind of the devotee is not diverted to many branches of uncertainties. Vidura's purpose was to be situated in that service of the Lord, wherein one merges undivertedly. He claimed the friendship of Maitreya Muni, not because he was Maitreya's son, but because Maitreya was actually the friend of all who have lost their spiritual vision due to material influence. Omagina timinandasya jananjana shalakaya jakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya mano bishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam upakara mayam dadati swaparantikam. So Srila Prabhupada says here in the purport that Vidura's purpose was to be situated in that service of the Lord wherein one merges undivertedly. And he also points out that, that was his purpose. That was his, maybe you could say his primary purpose. A secondary purpose that's mentioned in the translation is that he was asking Maitreya to kindly describe these pastimes of the Lord, so that for people who had lost their vision. So that was another consideration, another thing he was considering. Notice he was wanting to be fixed without diversion in the service of the Lord himself, and he felt that this was hearing these pastimes from Maitreya would be a means to that end. And he was also aware of the fact that it would be beneficial for those who had lost their spiritual vision. So is our good friend and excellent Chinese fried rice cook, Gauranga Prema, would say when he gives class, this reminds me of a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, but this reminds me of a purport from the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, very famous purport, where Prabhupada says, the word kriyashu, meaning by manual labor or by work, is important in this verse. One should engage in practical service to the Lord. In our Krishna consciousness movement, all our activities are concentrated upon distributing Krishna literature. This is very important. One may approach any person and induce him to read Krishna literature so that in the future he may also become a devotee. So that's what was one, that was one of the two considerations of Vidura, that other people would benefit. So Prabhupada's mentioning that here, that by receiving Krishna literature in the future, the people who receive it, they may also become devotees. Then he goes on to say, such activities are recommended in this verse. Such activities will always remind the devotees of the Lord's lotus feet. By fully concentrating on distributing books for Krishna, one is fully absorbed in Krishna. This is samadhi. So that relates to that point that Prabhupada made in the purport, that the purpose of Vidura was to be situated in the service of the Lord wherein one merges undivertedly. And Prabhupada here is giving us a formula for exactly how to do that, to accomplish or achieve both of these objectives of Vidura, to become situated in the service of the Lord undivertedly and to simultaneously benefit others. This book distribution, you know, Prabhupada said, as I just read, to any person and induce him to read Krishna literature so that in the future he may also become a devotee. And also that by fully concentrating on distributing the books, we ourselves, the devotees, the people who are doing it, we will be fully absorbed in Krishna. It's samadhi. So that's our program. We can follow in the footsteps here of Vidura by, you know, focusing on this mission, you know, that Prabhupada's give us to distribute the books. And in the translation, the words that Vidura uses, he says, kindly describe all those who have lost their vision. So people in the Kali Yuga, they've, not just people in the Kali Yuga, you know, conditioned souls throughout the history of, you know, creation, have they lost their spiritual vision. But in the first canto, the very first verse, I don't know what you call it, the keynote verse, or the verse in, you know, before you even open to the book proper, there's, in each canto, there's a verse that's highlighted. And the verse that's highlighted in the first canto is Krishne swa damo pagate, dharma ginadi bisaha, kalo nasam drusam esha, purinarko dinoditaha. And it points out in that verse that this Bhagavad Purana is as brilliant as the sun. It has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna. And that those who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance of this age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. And that's the remedy to restore people's, give people's spiritual vision by reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada kindly gave us the Bhagavatam. He translated it from Sanskrit into English. He gave us the translations, and he gave us his Bhaktivedanta purports. And it's non-different from elsewhere. There's another verse, a few verses before that one, Idam Bhagavatam Nama Pramanam Brahma Samhitam. And it goes on to say how the Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna. Oh, somebody wanted to quote it there. Is it? It's non-different from Krishna. It's actually a deity. And Ananda Kirtan, when he distributes books, he points out to people. Sometimes he says that. Whether they know about what a deity is or not. But he points out that, like, he kind of preaches to him, and he says, you know, an ordinary deity you have to worship. You know, you have to perform worship to it. This deity is worshipped by reading it. See? So just by reading the Bhagavatam, one is worshipping Krishna. And you receive enlightenment. The vision that was lost is restored by reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's a very, you know, beautiful program that Prabhupada's given us. And as we're all aware, we're kind of experiencing that as distributing these Bhagavatams is and books, Prabhupada's books in general, is easier than what we thought. Now, somebody might feel, and I just want to address this in a nice, hopefully pleasant way, that somebody might say, well, that's not my service. Well, yes and no. It actually is, it's all of our service. It's all of our service because even, you know, going back before Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya said, Yare deke tare kaha Krishna Padesh, Amare Gaya Guru Hana Tare Desh, as Ananda Kirtan quoted yesterday in his class. Lord Chaitanya said, wherever you go, whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna. And in this way, become a spiritual master and deliver everybody in the land. And also elsewhere in the Adi Lila, he says, I order every man in this universe to accept this Krishna consciousness movement and to spread it. And of course, Krishna, in the end of Bhagavad Gita, emphasizes the importance of preaching. So it's something, you know, that we all have, at least to some extent, is our responsibility to contribute some energy towards that end. And one interesting thought that came to my mind, and it came in an unusual way. A couple of days ago, I was just, I don't know how I started thinking about, but I was just thinking about these fellows who run the marathon, you know, the 26.2-mile marathon, and it was just reflecting on how they do it in under two hours. So that's 120 minutes. So I did the math, and it works out that they're running 26 consecutive miles, each at a clip of less than 4 minutes and 40 seconds. It's really like, it was inconceivable, you know. So it's just, for some reason, I was thinking about that. So I made a comment to Archie, after the class, you know, how do they do that? And he said, well, you know, they have a body that's designed for that purpose. And then he said, but they're not even doing as good as these pack dogs, these African hunting dogs, I think is how he referred to them. And which I'd never heard of. And he went on to describe to me how this animal in Africa, they're the most successful hunters. They hang out in packs, and they're not real big. They're a bit bigger than your ordinary dog, about so high like that. But they hang out in packs, and they can run at 30. And I looked it up on the internet, and to confirm what he was talking about, and he was right. They were able to go at about 30 miles an hour indefinitely. So what they do is they just, there's a pack, and they just head right into like a group of animals that they want to prey on, and they kind of separate one from the pack, and then they just chase it down. And while they're chasing it, they'll just follow it, and they bite its leg, they bite its butt. Or rump, I don't know what the proper way to refer to that is. They bite underneath. They just keep running, and biting until the thing just falls on the ground, and then they just devour it like that. So pardon the analogy, but we can operate like that. It's their teamwork. They're not big and strong like a lion or a tiger or something like that. They're just these little dogs, but they work unitedly, and that one dog gets it from this side, the other dog gets the animal from that side, and they just wear it out and they bring it down. So, in the same way, we can work like a team to distribute these Prabhupada's books, single volumes, sets like that, and in this way, we could have big success. We've experienced that, like just ourselves at the tables. Sometimes we're trying to distribute a book, set to somebody. And the person who starts off with that, the potential set purchaser, he's kind of running out of steam. And then another devotee who just happens to be standing there comes and says a couple things, and then somebody else says a couple things. And we all kind of gang up on the person, and finally he goes, okay. And he takes it, you see? So teamwork, So that's a good point. I just wanted to... You can go for a little bit of a tangent that, I don't want anybody to think that, I don't think that when I see things aren't going as well in the Krishna conscious movement as what I ideally would like to see them be going, like for instance in terms of book distribution or something like that, I don't feel all frustrated thinking like, because these devotees aren't doing this. And so what I'm saying is I'm hoping I'm not coming across with this kind of attitude that, because these devotees aren't doing this, the Krishna conscious movement, isn't doing as well as it could be. The Krishna conscious movement isn't doing as well as what I would like it to be doing because I have a material attachment. I take it upon myself. If I'm not satisfied with my experience of the Krishna conscious movement, it's not because of what other devotees are doing. It's me. As I have material attachments, and because of my material attachments, I'm not following as strictly as I should be following, and therefore I'm not getting the desired result. The tenth offense is to not have complete faith in the chanting of the holy names and to maintain material attachments, even after understanding so many instructions on this matter. So, what I described, that's my vision of how we should be engaging in devotional service individually and collectively. But at the same time, if I'm not satisfied with my experience, I take the responsibility. It's me. I don't think it's other devotees that are the cause of my not experiencing what I want to be experiencing in the Krishna conscious movement. And at the same time, I'm just using kind of myself as a bit of an example to make different philosophical points. But I don't think, if anybody else is feeling that, we should be strict with ourselves and think like that, but at the same time, we have to be patient. See, that's my understanding, but I don't beat myself up over it because getting that devotional service is the summum bonum. That it's the ultimate perfection of life. It's no small thing. It's a really great achievement to come to that conclusion that pure devotional service is the ultimate, the perfection of life. I mean, I'm trying to give an example of that. Durvasa Muni was a great mystic yogi. He was powerful. First off, he had 60,000 disciples. That's a lot. You take the biggest football stadium in America, that's about 50, 60,000 people. Imagine that's full. That's how many disciples he had, he could meditate. When he came to visit, Ambarish Maharaj, while he was doing the Ekadasi fasting, you know, he came and then he went off to the down to the river to do his noon duties. And it's described in the Bhagavatam, he was meditating in trance on Brahman. So he wasn't just like, he was a perfected mystic yogi. He was meditating. And then when he came back, you know, and he found out, he could nobody told him, he could understand by his elevated consciousness that Maharaj Ambarish had drank some water. So then he proceeded to curse him. He pulled out some hair from his head and he created a demon. He was offended. He felt offended. He felt like, you know, this man has not observed the etiquette. You know, he's eating before his guest. So he, and he was, you know, to be honest with you, he was kind of envious of Maharaj Ambarish to start off with, because Ambarish was a king and he was just an ordinary king, whereas Durvasa Muni was a sannyasi. He was a great, famous, perfected, powerful, mystic yogi. And, you know, he was thinking, he was feeling, I've heard Prabhupada in lectures say, you know, why is he getting all this fame and reputation and everything? You know, he kind of felt a bit envious of him. So anyway, so when this happened, he decided to, you know, to curse him. So he created a demon like that. Then, of course, when the Sudarshan Chakra, which Krishna had left at the palace there with Maharaj Ambarish, that's also stated in the Bhagavatam, he didn't send it from Vaikuntha. It was there with him to protect him. It kind of became activated. It destroyed that demon and it started chasing Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni was able to travel all over the universe to try to escape. He was feeling the heat. That's actually stated. And so first he went to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma said, hey, forget it. I can't help you. And then he went to Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva basically said the same thing. He went to Lord Narayan. And Lord Narayan said, sorry, can't help you. You have to go to Maharaj Ambarish. And if he, you know, if he forgives you, then you're that could be your peace. So he did that, you know. And, you know, he fell at the feet of Maharaj Ambarish. And Maharaj Ambarish was embarrassed. Anyway, everybody knows the story. But the point is that, wow, you know. And then he finally realized that the Vaishnavas were superior, and that, you know, devotional service was where it was at. So much so that he, after that incident, he traveled to Brahmaloka, to in the higher planets, not by airplane. This is described when he just used mystic mode of travel, and to share that realization with other personalities there. He was away for 1 year. During that 1 year when he was away, Maharaj Ambarish just drank water. He'd already done a fast for a whole year, not drinking anything and eating. Now he did it just for 1 year. He just drank water. And when Durvasa Muni came back, he fed him. Then Durvasa Muni told him, please, you eat as well. Anyway, so Durvasa Muni got it. But it took some doing. You know, the point I'm making is that even a great, great person, powerful personality like that, initially couldn't get it. And even devotees, sometimes we can, you know, even as aspiring devotees, we can kind of forget. Like Sobri Muni was a great Muni. He's referred to as Sobri Muni, but he was a devotee. He was a bit of a devotee. I mean, he wasn't like a total impersonalist. But anyway, you know, the story goes, he was meditating in the Yamuna River there, and it came to his attention that Garuda was coming in doing some fishing, right, so to speak. So he requested Garuda, please, could you stop? Leave this fish alone. And Garuda didn't want to disregard. He didn't. Garuda's Lord Vishnu's carrier, is not under anybody's order. He didn't want to disregard Sobri Muni because he just had a respect. But he did, before he left, he grabbed one big fish. He grabbed one who happened to be the leader of the fish, and he went off with him. And Sobri Muni became aware of that, and he said, I give this curse that if Garuda comes here and, you know, tries to get another fish, with all my strength, he'll die like that. So he, you know, made that curse, which was a mistake. You know, shouldn't have done that. But so anyway, so as a result of that, it's described in the Bhagavatam, he later fell down. He saw some fish engaged in sex life, and he became agitated, and he fell down, and he entered into household life. It's kind of an interesting story. he approached Mandata Maharaj, and he said, who had 50 daughters, and he said, I'd like to marry one of your daughters. Could you give me one of your daughters to marry? So Mandata Maharaj, who was a very great, powerful emperor, he said, well, my daughters are free to choose anybody they like, you know. So Prabhupada said in one lecture, he didn't say it in the Bhagavatam, but he said this way he was avoiding him, you know, because he was thinking, what is this useless old man? I'm not going to give one of my daughters to him. So Sobri Muni, he understood what was going on. He was no fool himself. So he decided, I'm going to transform myself into a young, beautiful, you know, man. And then so much so that all of his daughters will want to marry me. And he did that. And that's exactly what happened. They all wanted to marry him. So he got all the 50 daughters and he entered into household life. And he by his yogic mystic powers, he created a situation, a household life for himself that was far superior to Mandata Maharaj, and he became his false prestige was defeated. It's described in the Bhagavatam translations. Anyway, so he was enjoying household life, but at some point he reflected. He said, "What am I doing? You know, I was a sage. I was meditating, in transcendence." And anyway, he regretted it, and he decided he was going to return to his former practice of pursuing spiritual life. But I'm just trying to find this one exact verse. Oh yeah, here it goes. Okay, here it goes. Yeah, this is a part of his reflection. He says, a person desiring liberation from material bondage must give up the association of persons interested in sex life and should not employ his senses externally. He says, one should always stay in a secluded place, completely fixing his mind on the lotus feet of the unlimited personality of Godhead. Okay, so he was a devotee
of a sort.
And so the point is, once again, that it's no small thing to come to this conclusion of pure devotional service. Even these great, great, powerful personalities like Durvasa Muni, who could travel all over the universe, et cetera, et cetera. Sobri Muni was able to meditate underwater. You know, it means he had to be entranced. You can't breathe when you're underwater. They didn't quite completely get it. It took some, you know, kind of, they had to go through some learning process before they completely, clearly understood it. So in the same way, we have to be very strict with ourselves, yeah, and enthusiastic. At the same time, patient, because it's maybe not something that's going to happen overnight, you know, getting that realization. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions about any of these points? Okay, questions first, and then if we have time, we'll take a comment. Yeah. Oh, you want a microphone?
Doesn't matter how beautiful is one girl in this material universe or how beautiful is one boy in this material universe, my question is, you cannot compare with the beauty of Krishna and Radharani. Is it true?
Correct. Yeah, correct. Okay. Param drishtanavartate. Any other question? Okay.
That's it? Well, I was just going to make a very brief comment in regard to King Ambarish versus Durvasa Muni. Although Durvasa Muni had, as you mentioned, so many powers, one would think that King Ambarish would just be a pushover for him. All he had to do was desire to either to kill him or to hurt him, and that would happen because he was so powerful in his austerities and then the results of the austerities that he had powers. But the important thing that we can all learn from this is that real power, real strength, real greatness is not having something, but learning how to depend upon he who has everything. He who has everything is the Supreme Lord. And when we learn the art through Srila Prabhupada's books of how to depend upon Krishna, then even though we may be externally weak, have no particular power as King Ambarish, although he had a certain amount of physical power as a king to maintain a kingdom. Nonetheless, next to Devrasamuni, he was just a little midget, and Devrasamuni was a giant when it came to power. But the reality is that because King Ambarish was so dependent upon Krishna as his dear beloved, as the one who really had some meaning to him, as the one whom he felt all his, whatever power he did have, was the result of the blessings or the grace of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, in the ultimate analysis, King Ambarish was actually far more powerful than Durvasamuni. And that's what point is being made here, is that something may appear externally very, very powerful, but in the reality, it is not. It is very weak next to the power of Krishna. And a devotee who depends upon Krishna receives the grace of Krishna and, in effect, gains infinite power, the power of Krishna.
Thank you. Great comment. Anybody else anything? Okay. Thank you very much. Gantaro Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.